Exodus. It is Thursday, June 12th, 2003. This is an informational meeting, and we're having invited testimony on Comprehensive Neuroscience Incorporated. And on the phone with us is Sandy. And what's your last name, Sandy?
Forker. If you eat with a fork.
Okay, Forker, that's okay. Sandra Forker, PhD, Vice President. And with us...
Thank you, Chair Winters. I'm Tracy Davies from Eli Lilly, just here to flip slides.
And we're having a visual. This was the visual and the testimony that we were to hear several weeks ago, and... because we were compressed for time and we were not able to hear all the testimony. And I know it was, I think, if I can remember correctly, it was a very chaotic day that day. So I'm glad we're able to have the information today. And as members come in, they can join us. So you can go ahead and begin.
Thank you, Chair Winters. What we have done is we have actually shortened the presentation from the one we had put together for you a couple of weeks ago to make this one more salient and to also allow plenty of time for questions or queries that you may have about the product we're going to discuss. So if we can turn to the first slide, Tracy, please. What I'm about to do is to actually describe for you the Behavioral Pharmacy Management System product. This is a low-cost, automated system that really has and performs four functions. So what I'd like to do is walk through those four functions, because that's really the heart or the core of what this product is. The very first feature of this product is that it will profile prescribers of behavioral drugs for deviations from best practice guidelines. What I want to stress here is that this, while it will profile all prescribers, we in fact will be looking for the outliers, those prescribers that have the highest volume of prescribing activity and also have the most deviance recorded from a core set of edits, which I will go over with you in a few minutes. So this, one of the features of this and part of what makes it a low-cost intervention is that it focuses on outliers. And I'm going to give you some statistics in another one that basically says that if you profile about 5% of the prescribers, you catch about 50% of the cost of behavioral health drugs. So we have found this outlier approach to be a very viable and credible approach. The second feature of this product is that it really engages those prescribers that have been dubbed as outliers using multiple channels of targeted education messages that are intended to improve the appropriate use of behavioral drugs. And we do that through the use of annotated bibliographies, sending them articles from referees, journals. Those are peer-reviewed journals, as well as doing other interventions, which I'll talk about later. But these some targeted letters that, in fact, are aimed at basically making them aware of what the best practice is around a specific area. The third feature of this product is that it tracks changes in the use of behavioral drugs, so it will really track whether or not we're seeing changes in the prescribing patterns so that they match better with best practices, and it also tracks the cost, changes in the cost of behavioral drugs. So you, in fact, can begin to keep an account of where your savings are happening and from what specific edits they are coming from. The fourth feature of this particular product is that it tracks the refilling of prescriptions by high-risk patients that actually report non-compliance. So it actually will give us a report that we will be able to share with Medicaid, with mental health, with all interested parties, that will in fact target those patients that in fact have not been compliant, that they have not stayed on their medication for 90 continuous days. And it becomes an excellent tool in a medication management session with a client or with a patient in fact addressing the issue of whether or not they're taking their meds and hopefully avoiding inpatient hospitalization. We can go to the next slide, please. What you see here are the 12 quality edits for which we have 12 quality letters that really represent the core set of edits that would be implemented first. These 12, we found through our implementation that it is important to maintain the integrity of these 12 as the core set, but we are definitely open to other edits being added as the project goes forward. So this would be our starting point of 12 edits. So just to run through these with you, very briefly, therapeutic duplications of atypical antipsychotic drugs. We in fact often find here that what's going on is that a person may be receiving prescriptions from more than one prescriber, and this lets us know that. Excessive dosing, inadequate dosing. There are a few edits in here around children because it's in such an area of serious concern, and in fact some of these were added very recently. So just to let you know that the court set in fact itself changes as new information is available. But the first one of the children edits takes a look at children receiving three or more behavioral drugs. There's also one for adults receiving more than three behavioral drugs. The use of two or more drugs from the same class. Evidence of excessive switching of atypical antipsychotics. Antipsychotic persistence from multiple physicians. Use of sedative hypnotics for greater than 60 days. No timely refill, that's that discontinuance that it has actually become a highly valued edit by our physicians. Number 11, children receiving ADHD plus mood stabilizing plus sedatives, hypnotics, that's a new one for 2003. And then therapeutic duplications of antidepressants and mood stabilizing drugs is also new for 2003. And again, I just want to stress that we are open to other edits as this goes forward. That's important that you know we have that type of flexibility. We can go to the next slide, please, Stacy. What I want to do here is to just talk about the targeted intervention. And the first target of our intervention is to really be able to define and be able to identify the high-cost prescribers with quality DBA shunts. Less than 5% of prescribers actually equal more than 50% of the cost. In Missouri, where 323,000 prescribers actually were responsible for 53% of behavioral health costs. And AmeriChoice, which is a health plan that is also using this product, 100 of 2,400 prescribers were responsible for 51% of the cost. So it's
Sandra?
Yes.
Just, can we ask questions as we go along?
Okay. I would love for you to.
Representative Bates.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just so you know, I'm a state representative. I'm also a physician. So, I'm going to try to ask the questions that hopefully will make sense. When you talk about 2,300 prescribers, are you talking about all the prescribers, the internal medicine, peds, surgeons, everybody, or are you focusing on those who are most likely to write these types of prescriptions?
We actually use the Medicaid claims database, Senator. It can include internists, primary care physicians, anyone who is prescribing and charging Medicaid would be identified in this process.
And
we are looking at a select group of 90 to behavioral drugs.
And thank you, Madam Chair. Can I? Mm-hmm. Would that include the SSIs and minor tranquilizers?
Yeah.
Thank you. Interesting information. Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions? Because I can't see you.
President Wesson, did you have a question?
No, ma'am.
Okay. No. Please continue.
Okay. And please, Chair Winters, stop me if someone does it. If you're noticing someone has a question, because I obviously can't see you. Moving on, so, you know, one of the points here is that, you know, we have really, tried to, from the data we have, target the prescribers who, in fact, we should be taking a look at their prescribing practices. And we've done that really almost doing a cutoff when we hit 50% of the population. So we find that it's a very small number of prescribers who, in fact, are responsible for 50% of costs. They tend to be the physicians or psychiatrists who see the Medicaid population. There are also a series of multiple monthly interventions that we use. When we actually get to implementing these, we work very closely with both Medicaid and mental health. The final design of, for example, the quality letters, we can be flexible in some areas of implementation, and many of these that are listed here are the areas where we can be flexible. But again, what we would like to do is maintain the integrity of the intervention, and that really would include using that core set of edits, those 12 edits, as the basis for the analysis that we're going to recommend that we do treatment. So we have quality letters, we have an outlier report. I'm going to describe to you what happens with that outlier report over time. It also provides a patient's drug history, which many physicians have again found very useful. They've not had that before. It provides educational briefs on best practices. These are the annotated bibliographies and the jury articles that I was referring to earlier. And for non-responders, for those practitioners who are high volume, who have been identified as having outlying practices, the best practices, and if we do not see a change in any of their patterns, we actually do direct peer-to-peer. This can happen via telephone, one-to-one, or it can happen in small group expert consultation meetings. Next slide, please, Tracy. One of the most valued reports, and I mentioned this earlier, but I just want to reemphasize it because it's something we've received such positive feedback about, is the tracking of the failure to refill antipsychotic medication. And we are able to do this from the Medicaid claims database by just looking for breaks in 90-day continuous compliance. We also look at moderate or high-dose patients to see, you know, what their compliance looks like. And we actually send a letter of non-refill a non-refill notification to a physician and the plan no later than 30 days after we get discovered that this is in fact happening. And physicians have expressed great appreciation for this information because it's often something they're just unaware of, and it has helped them in their medication management visits with clients as we go forward. Any questions?
Continue, would you?
Okay. Tracy, if we could next slide. What I'd like to do now is go over the first year results for 2002 from AmeriChoice, which is a Medicaid HMO health plan in Philadelphia. Next slide. Of the top 100 providers profiled, I think this is very interesting information, and Senator goes to some of your question about who actually gets targeted. 89% of the top 100 providers profiled were out-of-network physicians. So there were people, there were physicians that were billing for Medicaid, but were not part of this plan, nor part of, you know, the plan's internal network.
Representative Bates, you're nodding.
I'm nodding yes. I would expect that.
Okay, okay. And that's exactly
and
what
that's
you're
finding. Interesting, but expected. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. The second one, which I think really speaks to the power of the product and the power of the intervention, is that after a year, we saw 30% turnover within the top 100 providers' profile. They actually had changed their practices to such an extent that they actually were now in the bottom 15 percentile. So sending them the best practice literature impacted their practice patterns. Thirdly, 44% of the providers lowered the average number of prescriptions written. And fourthly, 56% of the providers reduced total paid dollars for the quality edit claim. So there was, in fact, a significant saving in the cost of pharmaceuticals. And I have some more data on that. If we can go to the next slide, please.
Could I ask a question there,
please.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Representative Bates.
It's Representative Bates here again.
Yes.
Did you have any chance or any way, this is very difficult for you to do, but do you have any idea of how this affected the quality of care for those patients? I mean, it's, my information is anecdotal. I see patients constantly because I back up in the ER at nights, mm-hmm. coming in on huge numbers of medications. They don't know what they're taking. They've lost their prescriptions, and they're taking them wrong. Have you seen any idea of what the quality of life is for those patients as a result of these interventions? Do you have any idea of that at all? It's a difficult thing to measure, I know.
Yeah. Actually, we ourselves, this particular intervention, are not collecting quality of life data, but many of these plans, in fact, are doing that as well. So, for example, in Oregon, there's the Multnomah scale that I know the department uses, as in fact many other states and counties around the country have adopted from Oregon. So there are ways to wrap around that kind of data around this core product. But this product itself, and part of what keeps it so low cost, is that it in fact is not, you know, producing quality of life change data. But it is available through other systems, data systems within, the mental health system.
Are you, Madam Chair, follow up? Are you by any chance tracking something simpler, such as the need for hospitalization on an acute basis for mental breaks?
Again, this particular intervention focuses on changing prescribing patterns to match best practices. We are not tracking the type of information you're talking about, but it is tracked by the department. So, you know, there would be a way at some point to match these prescribers and these patients with outcome data that the department, mental health department, would have on these clients.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. You may continue.
Okay. Thank you. Tracy, do we have up the data site that's effective review all claims by the one with the two yellow bars?
Yes, it's up.
Okay, thank you. What I want to show here is if we look at the first column that says 15.3%, the national pharmacy inflation rate for behavioral pharmacy has been running about 15.3%. I actually just saw some Massachusetts data where they were at 13.8% in 2001, and they dropped to 13.4% in 2002. What's interesting here is that 1 year post-intervention, this particular plan dropped to 4.68%. So there was over a 10% reduction in the behavioral pharmacy inflation trend. And I think that speaks to the potential of this particular product in beginning to control pharmacy costs through educational interventions aimed at advocating for best practices in prescribing practice. Any questions on that slide? Okay, Tracy, next slide, please.
Please continue. And this is Senator Gordley, now sitting in the role of chair temporarily until Chair Winters returns.
Okay, thank you, Senator Gordley. What I want to show, what this particular slide shows, is really changes in behavioral pharmacy drug costs from the fourth quarter of 2001 to the fourth quarter in 2002. And if you look at the non-targeted patients, that these would be patients that were not seen by the prescribers that we had profiled, you will see that there was an increase in cost of 11.54% for those patients that were seen by non-targeted doctors in the fourth quarter of 2001, as compared to 0.31% for those patients that were in fact targeted. If you look at per claim, there was an increase of almost 9% in claims in the cost of claims for patients that were in the non-targeted group, as compared to a 3.76% increase in claims. And if you look at the total percent of change, there was almost a 19% increase in cost for drug costs for non-targeted patients, and there was actually a 5.36% saving for those patients that were being seen in the targeted physician group. So, you know, we really do have some evidence, albeit early evidence, that this intervention does in fact save money, and it does it through educational interventions aimed at changing physician practices to match best practices.
Madam Chair, may I ask a few questions?
Representative Bates, please.
I'm going to have to leave again here real quickly. I've got another meeting to go to, and the information you're presenting is very interesting and hopeful. We had a long discussion in a Senate committee yesterday that argued that managing psychiatric drugs was not cost-effective, that it prevented patients getting the drugs they actually needed, and that it would impact the rest of the system with increased hospitalization or other problems. And this is completely opposite to what we were arguing yesterday, and some of the people who brought this discussion forward, I think, were arguing the opposite case 24 hours ago. So it's difficult for me to put this together without the outcomes of this, which include not only reduced drug costs, but what the effect is on that population as far as acute hospitalizations and other issues of that nature. Marrying that data together is what is the key as far as I'm concerned. And I personally feel, and this is anecdotally, that programs you're suggesting probably are effective and it can actually produce better outcomes on the quality side, but we need information to prove to us that really does occur. I got caught in that crossfire yesterday, and I want to get caught in it again, frankly. And I think we need some resolution to that. So if you could give us a source we can go to possibly relate this data of decreasing cost of the pharmaceuticals to what the outcomes of that are in a broader picture as far as those who might be at risk for hospitalization or increased care in other parts of the system would be very, very helpful to us.
The best source I can recommend to you, Representative State, is there is the Kaiser Commission report of 2003. And that's K-A-I-S-E-R.
No, I know. I've read that report. Okay, yeah. I'm aware of it and read it.
Probably the one that has done the job of collecting data on both those issues.
I'll go back and review that again. I've read that one some time ago. It's thick.
Yeah, I think that does the best job of tying it together. And knowing that you have to leave, I'm going to skip the next slide. And
well, there's lots of other people here. Don't do that for me.
Okay.
I'm not going
here. What I wanted to do was to, because I think the next one is really, if you can put it up, Tracy, it just very quickly shows really the dramatic impact of this intervention. So for this particular plan, the total number of patients that were involved were 17,147. In that period, the number of patients for whom there were no edits, which meant that their prescribing was in line with best practices, was 9,906. Those that actually hit edits represented 7,241. If you remember, 30% of the physicians that were in the targeted 100 shifted to the bottom 50%. So in the fourth quarter of 2002, what we want to show you is that this is still very effective, because you always have new doctors circulating then into the highest 100. So in the fourth quarter of 2002, there were 17,655 patients. 10,804 of them had absolutely no edits, which meant the practices were in line with best practices, and 6,851 had edits. And this slide is in here to really show you that, in fact, doing this once doesn't make a difference. It's something that you have to do continuously over time to continue to get the cost savings. We could go to the next slide, Tracy, which is recommendations for action. What I wanted to do here is we have four basic recommendations for action to present to you today. I want to talk about these and also give you costs so you know what we're talking about. The first is we are really recommending that you make it that the decision is made to initiate what we refer to as the opportunity analysis. The opportunity analysis is a one-time run of the Oregon Medicaid claims data. It takes 12 months of retrospective data and analyzes it to estimate the potential savings to Medicaid and to identify where the best opportunities are for cost savings. So it runs 12 months of data up against those 12 edits that we looked at earlier. It then helps us estimate potential savings, helps us identify where the best opportunities are, and CNF can actually, once we receive the data, once the data transfer happens between Medicaid and CNF, we actually can give you the results of that opportunity analysis within 4 to 6 weeks of receiving your data. So there's a pretty quick turnaround for you where you can actually get some sense of the cost savings that are potentially available to you through this intervention. Based on the findings of the opportunity analysis, the second step would be to establish the number of outlier prescribers to be profiled. The size of the outlier pool should equal 50% of the drug spend. In one state with 481,000 Medicaid members, 300 prescribers are profiled monthly. This is actually pretty similar to Oregon. I think you've got a slightly lower number than 481,000. I think you're closer to 400,000. But we would recommend that Oregon begin by profiling 300 outlier prescribers. The third bullet describes or really deals with the cost, and I'd like to go through these with you and make sure that you're clear of what we're talking about. We would really, once the opportunity analysis has occurred, we've established the number of outlier prescribers to be profiled. The third step would actually be to initiate the monthly behavioral outlier management system. The base cost for the monthly report is $21,370. This includes the first 100 outlier prescribers. Each additional step of 100 outliers costs $8,120. So if we wanted to do 300 prescribers, we would be looking at $37,610 per month for an annualized cost of $451,320. All right, so let me run through the cost one more time because I want to make sure everyone's clear on the cost of this product. The base monthly cost is $21,370 for the first 100 outlier prescribers. If you were to decide to profile 300 outlier prescribers, it would cost you $37,610 a month or $451,320 annually. There is, in addition to that, there is a $27,500 cost for the opportunity analysis. That's a one-time fee, as well as a $7,500 setup fee. And that setup fee includes the initial data transfer, which is often quite complex, programming, testing, and the initial finding. So that the grand total for the project, there are no other costs, for a year that would include the opportunity analysis, the one-time setup fee, and the monthly cost for 12 months is $486,320. If we could go on to the next slide, thank you. What we wanted to do in the final slide before we open it up for hopefully more discussion is to really lay down some facts that we think are important to helping you deal with this particular issue in Oregon. The first is that CNS is ready to get the basics going. This is an automated system. It's ready to go. It's been up and running since 2001. It has bugs worked out of it at this time. And we are actually talking with 17 states about this intervention as I speak with you today. Not all of it's happening today, but it is happening on an ongoing basis. Eli Lilly, if we go to the third bullet, I think we should have put that next. Has agreed to support both the opportunity analysis and the monthly analysis through an educational grant. That educational grant comes to CNS, and we actually manage those dollars for Eli Lilly, which really puts them arm's length away from whatever's going on. They are interested in doing this because they support the creation of public-private partnerships to improve care. It is important for us to emphasize, meaning comprehensive neuroscience, that our product, the behavioral pharmacy management system, is in no way product-driven. It does not make medical decisions, which I think is a very important point, but it does support the use of evidence-based practices. That's what this intervention is about. The findings from the behavioral pharmacy management system will be shared with all interested parties. This is not data that will be, we have to know the secret password to get to. We think it's important. Providers will not be identified, nor will patients, but aggregate data will be shared. One of the things we have learned is that to get the desired result, it is critical to maintain the integrity of the product, which is that those basic 12 edits, but we really can be flexible around adding other edits in the future, and particularly around how we implement in a particular state. And that is usually done by putting together a steering committee that involves representatives from Medicaid, from mental health, and in some places it involves representatives from the university. It's really up to you to make those decisions. So, with that, what I tried to do is give you a quick overview of the product to give you some sense of its cost, to convey to you that we are really ready to go, to make sure that you have heard that CNS you know, is the recipient of the education grant from Eli Lilly, and that we, in fact, do that in order to maintain arm's length for Eli Lilly. So that's really the basis of my presentation for today. What I'd like to do now is Senator Sporley open it up for questions.
Well, I have a couple of questions for you, and one is you're talking currently with 17 states.
Yeah.
How many of these states are actually using or implementing the management system?
The one that has already started is Missouri. The two that are ready to go are Georgia and Pennsylvania. We've actually completed the opportunity analysis for Georgia, and Pennsylvania is like any minute, you know, Estelle Richmond, who is the Secretary of Health and Human Services, will be signing it. And the other one that is very close is Massachusetts.
And in those three states, or the four states that you named, all of those are recipients of the Eli Lilly grant? Or CNS has received the grant?
You know, there are different funding arrangements for each of these, and I'm not sure. I honestly can't speak to them. I can tell you Missouri is Eli Lilly, and I think Pennsylvania is. I'm not sure about Georgia or Massachusetts.
Okay. And then you may have shared this information before I stepped into the room, but how long has CNS been in business?
I'm sorry, how long have we been where?
Been in business, been in operation.
The company was formed in the winter of, or the spring, the summer of 1999. So we have been around now for just about, it'll be 4 years in August. We have three functions as a company. We do clinical trials for central nervous system diseases. We produce expert consensus guidelines for the treatment of mental illness, so we are very much into evidence-based practices. And our third major product is this behavioral pharmacy management system, which at this point is almost 2 years old.
All right. Thank you very much. And Chair Winters has stepped back into the room.
And my apologies for leaving the room. I'm kind of right now in between budget discussions and on the Oregon Health Plan and then running the committee at the same time. So my apologies, Sandy.
Yes, I understand, Chair. I was at one point the Deputy Commissioner for the New York State Office of Mental Health. And I remember being in similar situations.
Are there any additional questions? And where are we in the...
We have completed the presentation, and we were just beginning to take questions and comments.
Okay. Tracy, do you have anything to offer? Any comments? I know that your company is supported.
Thank you, Chair Winters. I think the presentation stands on its own. I personally don't have anything to add to it, but Eli Lilly has decided, I think at a corporate level, but more specifically here in the state of Oregon, that CNS has developed a pretty incredible product that really aims to improve prescriber practices, improve the quality of life for people who are perhaps not receiving the best dosage or number of medications. And I think they do it in a way that's very supportive of prescribers and those patients. And also it reduces cost in these budget times. Eli Lilly understands that that's critical. And that's why we've decided to get behind this project and offered to sponsor it so that the state of Oregon is not out any funds.
So Eli Lilly is prepared to sponsor a CNS to begin or to work with us to implement this kind of a program?
Yes, Chair Winters, that's correct.
Angela, I see you there. Would you come up and share? You just look like you had some comments.
I guess I always look like that. Chair Winters, members of the committee, my name is Angela Kimball, and I'm with the National Alliance for the Mentally Ill. There have been a number of discussions about the role of mental health medications and the Oregon Health Plan and how they will be covered and who will manage their cost. And because we are concerned on two points, this is of particular note to us. We very much want to make sure that the state is able to use its resources as wisely as possible, because that can result in a larger number of lives that are actually covered. That is of paramount importance to us. But of equal importance to us is that the quality of care for those with mental illnesses is respected and honored. This presentation feels to us like it is honoring both, in that it both manages costs while preserving quality of care measures for the population that we represent. This is in part why we have supported particular amendments to the Oregon Health Plan that would allow DHS to implement this sort of medication management. Our concern has been not that there be no medication management, but rather that the medication management respects quality of care. So in whatever form that this type of approach can be done, that we are very supportive of. Thank you.
Madam Senator Gordley.
Thank you. I think Representative Bates would really appreciate hearing that comment from you as well, given the question that he raised earlier. My question, we heard that the total cost of the project for Oregon would be $486,320. Is that the amount of the grant that Eli Lilly is prepared to make to CNS?
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, I think that's an estimated amount depending on the number of prescribers who are actually approached each month. If it is, in fact, 300 prescribers, we are prepared to support the program for the opportunity analysis and at least 12 months of educational outreach to those prescribers.
And so there would be no cost to the state of Oregon?
Chair Winters, Senator Gordley, there would be no cost.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Well, that's, and we appreciate the offer.
Is that a yes?
Well, you know, when someone comes and says, here they have a methodology,
yeah,
and they're willing to pay for it for 12 months, you know, that's enlightening, given our financial crisis.
Mm-hmm.
And also given that it provides a needed service. One, we talked about the quality, and also we talked about the hard audits. And it's the hard audit piece plus the quality that when we look at the Oregon Health Plan, the language that I believe that Senator Minnis is working on in 3624 is a hard audit piece. Last session in 2497, mm-hmm, we had requested some hard audit language in order to get some of the costs and some of those issues. So if you can combine both cost savings as well as quality, that's a win-win piece. So,
Madam Chair, I'm wondering also,
Gordley.
Thank you, if we have heard anything from, I see Ellen Lowe in the back of the room, and I'm just wondering if we've heard anything from Ms. Lowe on this particular proposal, if she has a perspective she'd like to offer or not.
Ms. Lowe, do you have any comments or words of wisdom for us?
I'm Ellen Lowe, Oregon Law Center, and This is the first opportunity I've had to look at it. I think that I would say that Representative Bates raised some questions about things that could be done and most likely should be done along with this that would be able to utilize this information then in looking at the quality of care that is there for the folks who are under the Oregon Health Plan.
I believe that in one of the comments to Representative Bates' question is that we do have the ability already in Oregon through mental health to do a wraparound service to get the quality data as well, and I think we need to explore that with mental health.
Chair Winters, and I think that as I look at this, I would make an assumption that also that maybe there are some things that OHSU in some of the work they have done in evaluating, looking at encounter data and evaluating the Oregon Health Plan, where perhaps they could become part of this. One of the observations that was made by the presenter that I note was that most of those that they worked with were out-of-network physicians. Mm-hmm. And I need to say that really as I followed the audit committee and then participated with Chair Winters in some of the evening sessions, I think that is one of the reasons that some of us are so strongly supportive of what I call coordinated care, but the system calls managed care. And that for most Oregonians, when they really do have a system that is there supporting them, their problems are less in health care.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Sandy, for the presentation and giving us this information. And get to Tracy, and I'm certain we will be back in touch. And with that, if there's no further questions, do you have any questions?
This is just a comment, if I may, to Tracy, given that you're representing Eli Lilly today. I recently had the opportunity to read a publication put out by Lilly, Saving Our Last Nerve, which is a publication designed to educate members of the African American community about mental illness treatment, demystifying mental illness, if you will. Excellent publication, just excellent.
Thank you.
And want to commend Lilly for the publication, and would love to get hold of multiple copies to share with the faith community in Portland and around the state. I think it's a publication that will really help us in our efforts to educate our communities about mental illness and give hope that there are treatments available and that there's also a role for the faith community in that work.
Chair Winter, Senator Gordley, thank you, and I will be certain to get you copies.
Thank you.
You might want to also get copies for at least for members of this subcommittee.
Yes.
That'd be great.
Thank you very much. And if there's no further business, we have no meeting tomorrow, but I think we do have pool tomorrow waiting.
Yes, we do.
So even though you're not going to be here for human services, you still have to be here to work tomorrow. So with that, we are adjourned for the rest of the afternoon. I'll see you on Monday. Now go to my room.